motion to approve the minutes of October the 16th. Is there any additions, deletions, or alterations to those minutes? Hearing none, is there a motion?
I move to approve the minutes of the October 16th, 2019 Public Utilities Commission meeting.
I second.
All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
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 Okay. Citizens' reports. James, do you want to start off here? Come on and say your name
Certainly. I guess I'll use this podium since I've got some prepared words. I also have one of my neighbors here as well. I understand there's a 3-minute time limit, and he'd like to give me his 3 minutes as well so I could have 6 minutes to speak, if that's all right with the commission. Thank you. Hello, my name is James LaFerrier. I'm a resident of Loveland. Before I continue with my prepared remarks, may I see by a show of hands how many people have solar electric power or their solar self-generators in the group? Okay. That's what I expected, because 99.6% of the people in Loveland don't have solar systems on their homes, but I'm in the 0.4% that does. I installed that 5.6 kilowatt solar electric system on my home this year. I knew Loveland didn't have incentives or rebates, but I committed my money to this investment because I believe in the environmental benefits of solar. Unfortunately, I was shocked to learn about the commission passing an aggressive policy meant to further disincentivize residents to who that have solar or that would install solar. I've examined the 4 major policies used by utilities which incentivize solar electric customers, and they are: 1, rebates paid to customers for installing solar. Loveland doesn't do that. Fort Collins does. Charging the same base fee for solar self-generators as all other residential customers. Loveland doesn't do that either. There's an additional fee charged to me and my neighbor because we have a solar self-generating. Annual net metering. Loveland doesn't do an annual net metering. There's a monthly net metering, and I'll discuss that a little bit further, but that penalizes us tremendously as solar self-generators. And paying the same buyback electricity produced as the customers are charged for purchasing electricity from the utility. Loveland currently does this, but what I found out is in 2020, this commission recommended to the city council to change that and reduce that buyback rate to the wholesale rate in which you get from PRPA. The combined Loveland policies of monthly bill settlement and wholesale prices for buyback electricity in 2020 will increase my monthly bill 28% to 38%. That's as compared to my current 2019 bill. And I have some handouts that I can show that using the rate structure that's on the Loveland Water and Power website. Personally, this is unacceptable to me, especially when the residential non-self-generators are only going to see an increase of 4.2% next year. My 28 to 38% seems quite high. My neighbor, his is expected to be 112% just using the last utility bill that he got this past month. So the U.S. Department of Energy states on their website that if we were to monetize the environmental health benefits of solar, it could add approximately 3.5 cents per kilowatt hour to the value of solar energy. This commission has recommended a policy starting in 2020 that the city council approved, which will actually subtract 2.5 cents per kilowatt hour from the value of the solar energy I produce. So there's about a 6 cent difference between what the Department of Energy says solar should be worth and what Loveland's actually going to pay next year. I'd like to have a serious discussion with this commission to understand why you've chosen to promote such an aggressive anti-solar policy. The current rate study, I've spoken with Mr. Bernowski about this, and he told me that the current rate study is not available for me to review. But I found errors on the presentation that was given to the City Council on August 27, 2019. So I have serious concerns that there may be some errors in the rate study. And because of those concerns that I have with the rate study, I request this commission stop the implementation of the 2020 rate structure change for solar self-generators until the rate study, its assumptions, methodology, and analysis can be assessed by an independent review or at least by the citizens of Loveland, to review the rate study to make sure that it is correct. So I have serious concerns that this commission is endorsing it, or did endorse and got passed a 25 cent per month increase to all residential basic charges, but you would not promote the 1 cent per month increase to incentivize solar self-generators in the city of Loveland. Furthermore, I don't understand why the commission does not support annual net metering, which I believe is the largest disincentive currently for solar self-generators in Loveland. I would also like to understand how paying wholesale prices for solar buyback electricity produced is equitable to me as a solar self-generator when I have almost zero transmission loss for the electricity that I put on the grid. Because as a solar self-generator, most of my electricity goes immediately to my neighbors. It doesn't have to travel miles from a production plant, a coal-fired production plant, to get to the point of use. I'm ready to have an open and honest policy discussion with you all, and I stand by for your answers and questions.
Okay. Well, it's my understanding that we didn't, with the 2020 rate structure, that we didn't encourage or discourage any self-generators. Just tried to be fair. Is that what you
That is correct, Mr. Chair. Our charge is to provide cost of service for each of our rate structure, for each of our customer classes. And that is what we did within this rate case. We will have another rate case in 3 years and we will reevaluate completely. But at this point, the direction from our city council has been for a number of years that there are no subsidies between, cross subsidies between classes. And as such, this rate structure for solar self-generation does reflect that, which is to not subsidize a class. The completed rate study will be available at the end of January. I have a couple of packets for you, all the materials from both of the city council sessions, and those did contain the structure and format of what the rates would be. And in that, we acknowledge that within the subset of solar self-generation customers, that depending on your usage pattern, and the size of the generation unit, that there would be people who would do better and others who would not do better. And that was fully acknowledged and understood by both members of this commission and by the city council. So I think that all of these factors were presented. They were presented correctly. We employed the use of a rate consultant who was literally a world-class rate consultant. I stand by the calculations that he made and the calculations of our finance team. Every utility does things differently. Every utility has different rate structures and has different directions. Some subsidize, some do not. For example, you mentioned that Fort Collins subsidizes. Indeed, they do, but they also have time of use rates, which are approximately 3 to 4 times what the normal off-peak rates are. So everybody does things differently. I believe that our rates are fair and that they are equitable to all residential and commercial classes.
See, I have a point of clarification. I thought when we got, if a self-gen had a credit for 1 month, I carried forward to the next month. If it ended up there with a $15 credit, am I wrong?
We settle up within the same month. So if they have excess generation in a given month, then they get credit in that month.
Yeah, but it doesn't carry forward if the bill says ends up being $15 credit?
It does not.
No.
It's net metering on a monthly basis.
Oh, really?
Yes, sir.
Is there a reason for not carrying your credit forward?
If you carry, it depends on how far you would like to carry it forward. I mean, if you could carry it forward to summer, you'd essentially be subsidizing again. This way, it is, everything is firmed up on a monthly basis.
Okay. I would probably agree with the self-gen guys that I don't understand why credit shouldn't carry forward.
The power that they produce is paid for, that amount is paid to them on a monthly basis. So they receive full cash credit for that.
But if they would have a credit, if what they use is the dollar amounts less than the amount they gave back.
It's a credit.
That doesn't carry forward, you just lose that?
No, you don't, no, nobody loses anything.
Well, that's not what I'm more confused.
If a customer consumes 600 kWh in a month, and if they have excess generation of 900 kWh, then they will pay retail for the 600 kWh, and they will be given full retail credit for the 900 kWh. And we are switching next year
you don't send a check, you just carry that dollar amount over to the next month.
Well, or it's applied to their other.
It's a total utility
else,
bill.
Like it lowers their total bill, so
it would be
applied against their water, stormwater, sewer.
The logic of why net metering on a month to an annual doesn't make any sense to me. It ought to balance out.
So that's a great question, but it doesn't because of the way solar is generated.
I don't want to go into deep discussion. You can do it with me afterwards. I'm the greenest guy on this commission.
That's good to know, sir.
And everybody knows that. I was also at Renewables Now in their last meeting, and so I just want to state one thing. I think it's very credible if you have a difference of opinion about our methodology, which I kind of agree with, this is unusual, I agree with Joe. I'm a rent consultant, and it's very good. So to convince me that our methodology is wrong, you really probably need to understand our methodology, obviously, better. But I don't think we should ever imply that we have staff trying to screw self-gens, pardon my term. And I've heard that, and I think that's inappropriate to do to our staff, who I think is as honest as the day is long, and it's not going to accomplish. If you want to change us or convince the council, we can't pass to incentivize anything. We can just recommend the council on that. But we need to play in a level field and not think there's some type of evil thing about self-gens. I support it all the time, and I recommended to incentivize when we passed it that night, and I was the only one. So it's not like they just didn't feel that way, and that's the way it's supposed to work. The majority says no, it's no. So pardon me for editorializing.
Yeah, we try and be fair.
Trying and being fair are two different things, right? So I'm in the vast minority here because I'm in the 0.4%. So my voice is very small, and it's very easy for the majority to make a decision that penalizes me in the minority. For example, what is the reason behind self-generators having to pay an extra fee or charge on the...
I really didn't want to get into a discussion, but that was fully explained in the presentations that were made to this commission and to the city council. There are costs that are recovered from a conventional ratepayer within both the base rate and then with the energy charge. Because solar self-gen customers do not consume as much energy as a conventional customer, some of those costs are not recovered. In which case they have to be, otherwise the conventional customers would be subsidizing the solar self-gen customers. There are a number of ways that you can do that. The way we've chosen to do that is to add a slight adder. It's not a fee. It is a slight adder to the base rate, and what that means is that everybody is paying their fair share of being able to be hooked up to the grid and have energy provided 24 hours a day.
So then let me ask you this question. For residential customers, not self-generators, who only use 500 kilowatt hours a month, then they would also have that fee applied to them because they're not purchasing as much electricity as someone who purchases 1,000 kilowatt hours per month, and therefore they're not paying their fair share of the grid
fees. We went into that, and it does appear that might be the case, but it is not the case. They are simply a lower user at the same rates with the same base rate as everybody else. And there are also people who are having 1,000 or 1,200 kilowatt hours. And you would say, well, maybe they're paying too much. It is the same rate and the same base rate. It, and it's done on an averaging basis. We cannot have 36,000 individual rates.
Well, I completely understand, but if I'm the same as those people purchasing 500 kilowatt hours a month, and I've invested $20,000 to be able to do that, why do I have to pay an additional charge when I've already paid for the infrastructure to create my electricity?
But that was your choice, not ours.
Yeah, did you go back one? If you take, first of all, the electricity we get from Five River Power is when we take it in. Their rates are based on when we goes on to our grid system. Our power from them is 74% of our cost. So the other 25% has got to be prorated some way. And I, so if you want to argue, you have to argue with that methodology there, and I'm not sure that that's all wrong. I've got two electric vehicles. We religiously charge them a night. If I was with another utility that does time of day, like Fort Collins, I'd be using cheap power. But that's not the way it works in the level. So yeah, I'm paying more than I think I ought to be, but I'm like you. I think I'm worried about our future for grandkids. But I think you guys should keep coming, but I would plead that sometimes it's hard to be diplomatic at times. When you talk about your pocketbook, it would be a little more diplomatic. But I don't quit coming.
Sir, I was trying to be diplomatic. I didn't say I was being screwed by anyone.
You did a good job.
I merely stated the facts, and I can show that my bill is going to increase 28% to 38% next year.
Because if you want to give me copies of bills, I'll be glad to take a look at them.
We always encourage the minority, sir.
Public come and give presentations. So come back again if you want to.
Okay. Well, one last question then for the group. Why is there no annual net metering policy here in Loveland? Because that in itself is the biggest detriment to myself, because my system was designed to produce 100% of my annual electricity needs. So when we do it by a monthly net metering, then I lose 2.5 cents for every kilowatt hour that I sell back, whereas if it was annual net metering at the end of the year, it would be zero. Everything would be zero for us. And
we will evaluate that in 3 years.
Yeah.
In 3 years.
Yes, sir. When our net rate next cost of service study.
Yeah.
Well, there's some confusion because from what you guys said, it doesn't make any difference. If I'm understanding it right, you should take what you're getting for credits monthly and add a month. And that's your equal annual net meter.
We'd have to discuss offline.
Okay, real quick, Gene, and then we've got to move on.
I think that meeting was a very expensive proposition, and that's why we delayed it off.
Right.
That's true. We feel like that's the appropriate time to be able to afford it.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, we've got four informational items. The first one was the financial update. Is there any questions or comments for Jim?
Yes, water sales are down. Sorry. It's the good news, bad news thing.
I guess I had one question because I'm pretty new to all this. Specifically on page 8, 9, and 10, which are the financial statements, I noted that the administrative line under the operating expenses was particularly under budget by a high percentage, and I just didn't quite understand that.
Jim, James?
Yes, the biggest driver for that is the fact that all three of the utilities are contributing toward the cost of the new utility billing system that's going to be coming online next year. And those costs, very little of those have been expensed so far this year. And so there'll be a big catch-up then later in the year, or perhaps even some that will be carried forward into 2020.
Okay, thank you.
Anything else? All right, let's move on to item number 2, water quality. And Tim's going to give us a presentation, I think.
Make sure it works. Okay. All right. Good evening, everyone. I wasn't expecting to be presenting to such a full house tonight, but this is great. This is really good. I was asked here tonight to come and present to you an overview of what the Water Quality Department does for water and power in the city of Loveland. I'm Tim Bowling. I'm one of the scientists with our Water Quality Department here. But I was asked to come here by Roger and Joe to give a brief overview of everything that we do, which actually is surprisingly challenging to do because there's quite a bit to it. So hopefully I highlight everything, you know, pretty big. Feel free to answer, or I'll answer any questions that you might have. And hopefully I won't get too far in the weeds for you guys, but hopefully this will give you guys a big overview of what we do. And also I'm going to provide you a little update on our algal mitigation efforts. It's been a few years since I talked to you guys about that, so I'm sure you're dying to know how that's going. So to start off with, I wanted to talk about, who are we? Well, we are 8 staff members. We're 7 full-time and 1 seasonal staff member. That's us right now. And that might seem like a lot of people, but when I go through everything that we do, I really want to highlight, you know, how much we get accomplished with this kind of small group that we have. All of our scientists and analysts and staff members are certified chemists, biologists. Some of them have their operations certifications. They're also certified laboratory analysts for water and wastewater. And everyone has degrees in chemistry, biology, ecology, environmental science, engineering, microbiology. So we're a pretty qualified and scientific group, that's for sure. And right now we are currently split between 2 locations. Our 2 labs are at our water treatment facility and our wastewater plant as well. All of our staff rotates through both of these labs, and that is unique. For a municipality of our size, there are only 3 others in the state of Colorado that are combined water and wastewater, where the staff do both, and we are one of them here in Loveland. And that's definitely great for knowledge expansion, but it also has its challenges because our scope of work is quite broad. But we do handle water and wastewater as one small group, as opposed to if you look at other municipalities like Fort Collins or Denver Water, they have wastewater and they have water that are separate. So when I thought about what is the easiest way to talk about what we do, because there is quite a bit, I wanted to explain it from source to source. So our water quality group monitors everything from the headwaters in the Big Thompson River to downstream of our wastewater plant and everything in between. So we have a source water monitoring program, and I'll go through each one of these in a little bit more detail. We handle the regulations and process optimization for the water treatment facility. We handle sample collection and testing out in our distribution system and customer taps. We handle special studies and analysis in our wastewater and sewer collection system. We handle the process optimization and compliance testing for the wastewater treatment facility. And we monitor health of the river downstream, going to the other users that are further down from us. But our primary focus is regulatory compliance. And this is really where the health and safety of the entire city comes into play, is by looking at the Safe Drinking Water Act, which are our water regulations, and by looking at the Clean Water Act, which are our wastewater regulations, and most importantly, protecting the water going downstream to future users. This is really, really important, and this is our primary focus. But we do a lot more than just regulatory compliance, and so I'll step through each one of those. We have source water monitoring programs, and the last time I was here, I presented to all of you about our reservoir monitoring and some of our algal mitigation efforts. But we also have a similar program going up the Big Thompson River. We have a monitoring program where we have multiple sites that go on different confluences of streams or different lakes or water bodies that could have contaminants of concern that we need to watch for, that could have elevated nutrients that would affect algal growth. You name it, we go up and sample it, multiple sites up the river. We also participate in a program called Contaminants of Emerging Concern. This is a program with Northern Water where we go and collect samples to look at things that are not regulation-based yet. These are things like you've heard a lot of issues with Roundup or bug spray or things like that. We'll collect these samples and see if there's things that are creeping up that may be potential treatment challenges for us in the future. So we participate that as well. And we also manage an early warning station. So up near the Cherry Pie store up the canyon, we have a monitoring station up there that 24/7 is watching the health of the river. It's linked via satellite to our water treatment facility, and it can give a heads up to our operators if they need to shut down their intake, if we have a big turbidity event happening, which was very frequent, that dirty water coming down with all of that construction. And it also acts as a flood warning gauge, and we manage that as a water quality group. We also have the Green Ridge Glade Reservoir Monitoring Program, where we've done our algal mitigation efforts. We have a monitoring program where we go out on a boat. We have multiple sites across the surface of our reservoir. We collect samples from multiple depths. We look for dissolved metals, algae, nutrients, quite a few other parameters as well that could impact water treatment. And we mainly use that to optimize the water we're pulling into the plant. Obviously, most notable is taste and odor, but we also do that for other things that you can't see, like manganese and iron and other metals. So we go out and monitor this, make sure we're always pulling in the optimal source water. But it's been a while since I was here talking to you about algae, and I don't want to get too far in it, but I wanted to highlight some of the successes that we've had with installing those solar beam mixers and really all of the multi-barrier algal mitigation approach that we took. So when I was here last time, I was right where that arrow was. That was the installation of those reservoir mixers. And since then, I want to say that we've had great success. Before we installed these, before we looked at carbon optimization, before we looked at gate intake level selection and reformatting that monitoring program, as you all know, we had numerous events with very high levels of taste and odor going out. And that's what this graph is showing here. The red line is that concentration of geosmin, that's the taste and odor, that the majority of the city can taste, that the majority of our population can taste. That orange line right there is where the most sensitive people can start detecting it. And anything below that, people can't detect it. And so the really important thing to highlight here is just the scale. We had multiple months, prior years, where we put out detectable taste and odor to our population. Since we've taken on our algal mitigation efforts, we've only had a matter of a few days. And most importantly to note, as we've continued to optimize this, 2019, we didn't have a single detectable event this year going out to our population. So this has been a great success for us. It's obviously still a work in progress. You never know what algae is going to do. But so far, it's been working pretty well, and we're continuing to optimize that year over year. So we're pretty happy with that.
Sorry, can I ask a question? Refresh my memory. Is it the die-off that it's curious that it's the winter versus the, where you think the bloom would be the trigger?
So typically, the taste and odor compounds do come from the die-off of algae. They hold these compounds inside their cells, and when they die, it leaks out. So there's a few other things that can influence it, but yeah, it's usually late fall. You see the big bloom, then they die off, and that's when you get that.
And if memory serves, when you presented this to us last time, you weren't entirely confident if it was solar bees or the other things. Mm-hmm. Now that you've had a few more months under your belt, I noticed you highlight solar bee. Is it you feel like that's a majority?
It's probably the main contributing factor to it, but really it's been source water optimization as well. We've looked at utilizing the river more than we have in the past at different times of the year. The solar bees have helped keep the algal blooms much lower than we would have seen them without them, but it definitely didn't prevent it entirely. So it's been the multi-barrier approach that did it. I would say the solar bees are a major contributing factor, maybe about 60% of the success that we've seen there.
So the river more than CBT?
The river more than our reservoir water. So we can pull our CBT from multiple sources.
Okay.
But typically utilizing
at the plant.
Oh,
got it. Okay.
Yeah. So definitely some good success there.
Great, thank you.
Absolutely. So there the water flows into our water treatment facility, and our main purpose, like I said before, is compliance testing and making sure that we're meeting all those regulatory requirements. And this list that you see here is just a few of those parameters and contaminants that we monitor on a daily, weekly, monthly, annual basis. And this is not an all-encompassing list by any means. This is just the primary and secondary drinking water standards that we're made to comply with through the EPA. But that just kind of gives you a snapshot of what we monitor throughout the year. We also work on process optimization. Obviously, algae is a big one. We've worked on carbon optimization. We've looked at coagulant efficiency, sludge removal. If there's something that has an analytical need behind it, we will help the operations staff out with that. And we do the database management. We program this internally at our water treatment facility, out in our distribution system, wastewater plant. There are numerous continuously monitoring pieces of equipment that we pull into our database. We combine that with all of the laboratory analysis that we do, and we use that for our regulatory reporting. So we're going out there and doing those, monthly. We have different monitoring schedules every 3 years, every 9 years, annually, every 2 years, every year. Depends on what we're looking at, but we use that to report on all of that. And we also do general chemical analysis out there. So there's a lot of things. If you look at the bottom of this table, these are our secondary drinking water regulations. These are things that we are not required to comply with, but is recommended by the EPA. It's basically, yes.
Now, where's the bulk of your compliance reporting going to?
The bulk of our compliance reporting goes to CDPHE, or the State Health Department.
Okay.
Yeah, they have primacy, so they're basically our face of the EPA.
Is there any national reporting that you have to do?
No, most of our reporting goes to the State Health Department. Here in Colorado, it's handled by CDPHE. So these are parameters that you see here that are basically optimizing your water. There aren't things that you're required to meet, but we analyze for all of these. And we put this out on a monthly report to our population. You can find it on the City of Loveland Water and Power's website. But it's our way of increasing transparency and letting the customers know what's in their water and letting them know that not only are we meeting regulations, but we constantly exceed them as well. So we do numerous other chemical analysis. And then you all have probably seen it. We put out an annual consumer confidence report that just is a snapshot of some of these as well. From the water treatment plant, the water flows into our distribution system and then well back into our collection system. And I could go over numerous lists and regulations for this, but I wanted to highlight some of the big ones. Out in our distribution system, we go around to consumers' taps and different businesses and we collect bacteria samples. This is for a revised total coliform rule that we're mandated to do. And this is to check if our water is contaminated or if it's safe to drink. So we'll go out to 80 sites equally spread throughout the city, and we rotate through these different ones every month. And we collect these and we evaluate that. That's a portion of the analysis that you see there, make sure that the water is safe. We also do lead and copper rule. I'm sure you all are familiar with that. You've heard of Flint, Michigan and other issues. We comply with that. We do the sampling and analysis for that here in-house. And recently, we did the school lead program. So Sandy there is our metals analyst, and she analyzed almost 3,000 samples from the Thompson School District, every faucet, every fixture, to ensure that the water our children were drinking was safe. So that's something that we've participated in. We also do general regulatory sampling, and like I said, this definitely doesn't...
A parent calls and says, I think my kid's getting lead. You follow up, or Sandy follows up, right?
Right now, the school district would be, but they're utilizing our data to prove that their water's safe. And the ones that they have found elevated fixtures, they've gone ahead and replaced all of those faucets.
How often do we get, does the school?
This has been a new program.
Huh?
It's been very new. It's been recent. It's been within the last 2 years. But we will probably see this continuing on, and we'll probably see it continue with daycare facilities.
So it's a good program to be doing.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And school grades are up?
I would assume so. Right? Actually, the ones that had the highest lead results were all the schools I went to here in Ohio. But, you know. We also do disinfection byproduct sampling. When you chlorinate water to disinfect it, it has other compounds that forms that potentially could be cancer causing. We monitor for that to make sure that that's not a concern. We do that in our distribution system. We do unregulated contaminant monitoring. These are things, like I said, with that emerging contaminant program. And our drinking water itself, is there something that's not regulated or new coming up that we need to pay attention to? We go out and collect that and look into that as well.
What are a few of the unregulated contaminants that you're looking at?
If you've heard of PFAs or what's another one out there right now?
We're doing perchlorate was one.
Perchlorate.
Cyanotoxins.
Cyanotoxins is a big one. When I talked about the algal mitigation study before, we had talked about the toxins that algae could produce. There's currently no regulations that we're required to meet for that. There's health advisories, but that was something that we collected that potentially could be regulated in the future. And we look at other general water quality, yes?
Sorry, before you jump that, are there unregulated emerging contaminants that are on the radar in the water community, not necessarily here in Loveland, that are, the best way to describe it, are just not addressed with chlorine?
That are not addressed with chlorine?
Yeah, that would require some further advanced treatment that we're not currently plumbed for.
You know, chlorine is our main disinfectant. So it's made to target, you know, we're looking at bacteria, we're looking at cryptosporidium, we're looking at giardia. And right now, there are things coming up that aren't on the unregulated contaminant monitoring rule, but you can look at things like Legionella. Legionella is a really big one that chlorine doesn't do much with. And you see that typically in hot water systems or large building systems that have old water age. the chlorine goes down in it. It allows this bacteria to grow, and that can make people sick. So there are things like that. Legionella is one of them. And currently we're researching that, and we're going to put out some informational material on that. Even though it's not required of us, it's something that, you know, consumers need to be aware of.
Tim, real quick. Remember, chlorine is attacking microbiological.
Yeah, mixed up.
And on the UCMR, it's both chemical and biological, microbiological potential contaminants. And so for some of these very exotic chemicals, there would have to be some other type of treatment to get those out of the water pump.
THC is one. You look at human hormones, you know, with birth control pills and estrogen coming, caffeine, things like that. Was it stuff that conventional treatment won't treat?
Well, that would sell more water, just say it's caffeine.
That's right, yeah. Well, I thought about it with our algae, it has chlorophyll, people like to drink that, but that didn't go over.
I know when I was at HP, we did some water treatment things internally. Is anybody doing that presently in the city?
You mean like reverse osmosis?
And there are a few users that do that. I mean, you see that with medical clinics, dialysis clinics. Some of the breweries do that. They want to remove the chlorine from the water for their beer. So you do see it, but nothing because they're concerned about, you know, the health and safety. They just want to further optimize it. But we do see that.
Yeah, we had a pretty extensive environmental health and safety department, as well as processes that required, you know, additional treatment and so forth. So we used to do that. Yeah. I'm sure there are other people.
Yeah, we see it frequently, and that's one of the reasons that I put out that other report I talked about earlier. It helps them target their treatment for whatever they might need. And then we do other chlorine, pH, hardness, alkalinity, you name it. We sample that out in the distribution system to make sure that the water is fitting all of our requirements. And also, we are the main face for the customer interaction when it comes to water quality. We handle those customer inquiries, customer complaints, and sometimes we even go visit consumers' homes to do testing to give them reassurance that the water is safe, you know, following a line break, following a flood, or if they're just generally concerned, we'll go out there and address concerns that they have. Out in every one of our distribution tanks, we have chlorine analyzers, pH analyzers. We go out and maintain all of those. And the reason that we do that is when water is sitting in a storage tank, it can age, it can lose that chlorine residual, it can change its characteristics in it. So in each one of our tanks, we have continuous monitoring instruments that we go and maintain to make sure that that water is as good as it can be, and we try to optimize some of the water usage that we have. We also perform special studies. Currently, we're looking at hydrogen sulfide reduction out in our collection system. That obviously could postpone capital improvement projects, and it could also help improve health and safety. Hydrogen sulfide can be a deadly chemical out there. If we can reduce that, that's a benefit to not only our employees who are working there, but our citizens. And then also, if we can reduce it, it can lower the corrosion and hopefully postpone some capital improvement. So we help with studies like that. We're currently looking at selenium in our collection system. Selenium's a big hot topic that's coming up for our wastewater permit. We're looking at that, helping do trend analysis with that and analyze that. And then also we help provide support to our pretreatment department, go sampling and analysis for whatever they may need. So from there, it flows into our wastewater facility, and likewise with the water treatment plant, we do the compliance testing and reporting down there. This is a little snippet of some of those tests that we do at the wastewater plant. Actually, our testing load is more intensive at the wastewater plant. We have much more daily tests that we have to perform. And this is really to protect the health and safety of the communities downstream from us. Make sure that what we're discharging is safe to discharge into the river. We also do river temperature and nutrient monitoring both upstream and downstream of our wastewater plant. As you all know, we just did a biological nutrient removal upgrade at the wastewater plant that was driven mainly by Regulation 85. Regulation 85 also has requirements to sample upstream and downstream as to verify that your processes are working. And also we have to monitor temperature. With Regulation 31 coming up, there might be temperature limits, and so we do have to monitor that and make sure that we're not elevating the temperature downstream of our wastewater plant too much. So we handle that. We also do biomonitoring. We collect samples to make sure the water leaving the wastewater plant isn't toxic and harming aquatic life. That's a state-mandated program that we have to do quarterly. It's mainly protect the macro invertebrates and fish. The way we get rid of sludge at the wastewater plant, or our solids, is through our sludge, and we land apply that to fields, and crops are grown with it. We do all the testing of the sludge down there to make sure it meets all the requirements and that we can get it out of our facility. We also provide process optimization guidance, just like at the water treatment plant. And we also do the database management and reporting for the wastewater facility as well. And we also provide a lot of lab training. So at the wastewater plant and also at the water treatment plant, the operations staff themselves do a lot of the basic process control testing, and we'll provide training for them on how to do that. If they need to know how to test pH, how to run chromium, something like that, we'll give them the training so they can do that themselves. And likewise, we do analyzer verification. We help the operations staff calibrate and make sure that all of their instrumentations are reading accurately. But we do more than that. We have a lot of different partnerships out there that we work with. And here are just some of those. We work with an organization called the Big Thompson Watershed Forum. We also sit on the board of directors of that. It's a nonprofit organization that looks at the health of the Big Thompson Watershed. There are numerous organizations involved, City of Fort Collins, Greeley, Northern Water. It's an opportunity to look at monitoring, evaluation to make sure that, you know, the water quality is being protected. We partner with the USGS. We provide analytical support for some of their sampling programs, and they also help maintain some of our stream gauging stations. We worked on numerous product and method developments with different organizations and companies. Hawk is a big one I'll highlight. They're close with us, but those analyzers I told you are out in our tanks, we help develop those. And since then, it's been used in numerous other organizations to improve the water quality in their tank systems. We also got new methods approved for ammonia. And the method that we helped get approved through the EPA with ammonia was something that now numerous other organizations can use that cuts their sampling time and testing time by half. We partner with neighboring utilities. Currently, we're helping City of Wellington learn how to test their wastewater. Historically, they've outsourced most of that, but with their growth, they're wanting to take that in-house. So we've been consulting with them on how to do things like pH and BOD and TSS. And we work with other city departments. I'm sure you all have seen the swim beach closed down because of E. coli. Well, that's us testing that for them. But we help them with that to make sure that the water is safe for people to swim in. And we do numerous community outreach events. We participate in all the children's water festivals, river cleanup events. We had a museum exhibit that talked about the importance of water quality here in the Big Thompson. We put out monthly reports, and we attend all of the Passport to Water events that there have been. And we also present at numerous trainings and symposiums, and we also give other trainings for, you know, laboratory certification information, things like that.
Sorry, before you jump, yes. On the Watershed Forum, back when I was involved with them years ago, I think I remember it right that Loveland was actually one of the only partners that had a certified lab and samples would actually run through the city. Is that still the case?
That's right. So now we utilize Fort Collins for some of their laboratory services, but they still utilize us for all of our bacteriological analysis. And then the other is outsourced through USGS, so that way it's unbiased third-party data. So looking forward, we're getting a new combined laboratory facility. This is being built at our water treatment plant, and we're very excited for this. Like I told you right now, we are split between two locations. We're kind of all over the place. Now, we're still going to have to go all over the place, but we'll be able to analyze everything in one location once this comes online. So we're very excited for this. It's going to really improve collaboration, get our staff together in one spot, and it's also going to give us the space we need for new instrumentation. So ideally, we're hoping to get new instrumentation that will help with some of that taste and odor analysis, some metals analysis that you saw there that will actually help us count algae. We're hoping to be able to bring that in now that we have the adequate space for it. So we are very excited for the new laboratory facility.
What's the timing on that?
So it's under construction right now. We're about halfway through with it and should be completed mid-next year. And with that, that was a big overview. There was a lot to it. Is there any other questions?
So what's your degree in?
My degree is in biology and chemistry.
CSU.
From CSU. Yeah.
Did you do a good job?
Thank you.
Back to the first slide of the smiling faces there and the seventh staff, just out of curiosity, how's recruitment and retention with sort of a unique niche of an industry, and I suspect people want academia as a career path?
Yeah. You know, it's very interesting because when you go to college, I mean, I actually went to college to become a surgeon. Never thought about going into water and wastewater. It's something that's not promoted. you don't see it.
Yeah.
But the people that we do have are very passionate about this. I mean, we have environmental scientists, we have chemists, we have people who, you know, really want to help the community. And so we don't have a problem with retention, and all of our staff members are very, very, very happy to be doing what they're doing. We have one back there right now because she's so excited to be here. No, it's good.
So the new building's a cool thing.
It will be, definitely.
So how big was the gym going to be?
The gym?
You can't talk about that.
No.
You're not too far from Chilson, though.
That's right. Mm-hmm. All right, anything else?
Oh, very good.
Thank you.
Nice. Yeah, thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to just add one point if I could. Sure. Tim is very modest, and he's a very modest individual. Our laboratory staff does an outstanding job. Ruth Hecker's back there. She's the driver of all of that. She won't admit it, but she is. And she does a great job, and these folks are out there every single day of the year doing something at one of the plants, or doing something out in the distribution system to protect the public health of this community. They do an absolutely wonderful job, and we're really, really excited about the new laboratory. So that'll be here in a few months.
Good. Brian, you want to talk about our water supply?
Brian?
He left a second ago. He's preparing.
Well, then let's go ahead and
agree.
This is a very, very early peek at what's going on. There's a kind of a drought situation going on down in the southwest part of the state, but so far looking good in other parts. But this early in the season, these numbers could be virtually nothing. They have to wait and really get farther into the season before they start to really have relevance and take out really. So the best we can say is we're off to a good start, it looks like, and we certainly hope that that continues that way. Ryan, do you want to add anything?
We've had several questions from Councilor Olson before about why sometimes the drought map that's included doesn't match the snow water equivalent.
Yep.
So, and we've basically indicated that there's a soil moisture content. So we had a really good 2018 for this last season, 2019 snowfall. And that definitely helped. It brought the southwest part of the state out of drought for a while. But then we had a really dry and hot, relatively, mid-July, August, September. So we especially saw that in the southwest part of the state. Even though we're doing real well here with snow for this time of year, we had some early storms that really helped. They're kind of back in a very moderate drought. And it has to do with like the soil moisture content and other contents that were affected by the dry, hot weather we had over the summer. And they haven't had as much snow as we've had here in the spring. In the fall coming in here. Any questions about the rest of this? You see they're in a pretty moderate D2 drought in this area. This area is moderate. This area is getting a little worse. I think I noticed a map that Nathan was looking at, updated earlier this week, and they're getting a little drier out here too. Than what this shows. This was updated from last week. Yes.
Yeah, your snowtell diagram actually does show that the southwest corner of the state is quite a bit lower than the rest of the state.
Yes, that's true. Yeah. Any other questions about the water supply?
Keep your fingers crossed.
So far for the South Platte, we're looking good. And I just saw a snowstorm brewing in the mountains looking out west right before this meeting, so we'll see what comes out of that. Okay.
All right. Amy's going to talk to us about water leaks.
Oh, thank you. All right. My name's Amy Rupp, and I'm a CGIS specialist here at Water and Power. And what I was working on is a new functionality that we have through CityWorks. So it's a new extension. And what this data is built off of is the CityWorks data. So we have quite a nice history of using CityWorks and GIS at the city. So we have a lot of good base data to build some neat analysis information from. And what you're looking at is an EURL extension to CityWorks where I was able to create a map, basically, of all the water leaks since 2014. So I have the different years organized by color. If we go down in this table of contents, I also have a heat map. So the places where multiple leaks have happened over time are a little hotter than the rest of it. If you zoom in on this, so say we've got this one spot that's pretty hot. There it goes. And if I click on this, I can actually get the repair main information. So these are based off of the work orders that have been put through the system where the water leaks have been basically taken through their paces and fixed over time. And I have 12 at this one spot, so obviously this is a problem area, so that might be something to look at, possibly replacing the main rather than keeping on repairing it. And you can actually step through all the different leaks that have happened. And I'm able to cull this information down to whatever the fields are that you're most interested in, so you're not getting a ton of blank fields for things that haven't been filled out. So these are allowing you to step through all the leak information, all the work orders associated with that leak information over time. That's pretty handy. What I've also included is an average equipment, labor, and material cost over here on the left-hand side. So it's done as a gauge, so of course, unfortunately with the resolution of the screen, we've got a little kind of wacky font thing going on here, but on a regular computer screen, it looks pretty good. You've got everything from zero to the most expensive, and then I've averaged the cost over time from 2014 to now, breaking it down by equipment, labor, and material, and total cost. And then down here I have a couple of charts, which if I make this a little smaller and squash this a little bigger, you can actually expand these different pieces of the dashboard to see things a little clearer. And this is the that total cost per year. So, and if you hover over the bars, it gives you the total cost of water repair mains over the course of that year, which is kind of cool. Here I have the number of leaks by year. And what's nice is we're almost done with 2019. We don't have so many. So we're headed in the right direction. What these tools allow us to do is to analyze the data over time. So we can see where our problem areas are very quickly. This is real-time data, so as new leaks go into the system for 2019, they will be put right into the dashboard. And this right now is available internally to our internal staff. We can post things externally depending on, the access to information that folks should have. And we do have more maps planned in the future. So something like this for the fiber design and build progression, people will be interested in that. Water pipe quality over time, daily operations, what's going on during the day, what are they finishing, what are they working on next, helps with routing, knowing where the team needs to go next. Also customer call tracking, so tied into Tim's presentation, those algal blooms where we got a lot of customer calls, we could actually map customer calls in real time and see where our problem area started and then just see it bloom out from there and go, oh, we probably ought to go look at this area because that's where all the calls have started from. Luckily, we don't have algal blooms to have to worry about that too much anymore. But that's just something that we could use these maps for. So again, based off of data that we already have in the system, we have a very mature system in terms of GIS and in terms of CityWorks, so we can track work orders, service requests, and inspections. So that's good for internal use in terms of daily operations. What do you need to do today? Where are the calls coming from? Are there any questions? Yes?
I noticed you have quite a concentration of repair work on Wilson Avenue north of Highway 34 and before 22nd. Was that mainly due to the break in that or the repair of that water line?
Yes. I mean, at the end of the year, we always analyze where most of the breaks have come through and then look at those areas as being the place where we probably ought to replace a section of Main where we're having the most breaks. But this kind of tool will help us analyze that even faster.
Well, that was quite a project to replace that main through there at home.
Yes. A lot of rerouting. Yes, sir.
Amy, can you zoom out a little bit on
sure.
the map? So one of the things that strikes me is that some of the oldest parts of town there south of Lake Loveland seem to have a, you know, a lesser amount of breaks, at least over the last 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting.
It is interesting. I live in the old part of town too, so that is interesting.
It is. It's very interesting. What would you think the majority of the pipe material of construction would be in that older part of town?
Iron.
Cast iron. Cast iron, and the cast is surprisingly robust from a material standpoint, from the strength of materials. Where we get in trouble is on the inside, where you have heavy tuberculation, which impacts water quality. It impacts pump water flow, reduces the efficiency of pumping. That's the problem. Now, if you go up to the area, say over Taft, 22nd, 29th, Gene, the project you were talking about that we did on an emergency basis last year from Eisenhower up to 22nd, that was all ductile iron. And by rights, if you read the literature, the age of that pipe, it should not have been replaced. But there was a problem with the installation of it.
I think you had a problem with the bedding of the pipe.
The whole installation process, that's exactly right. And from a concern standpoint, years ago when they were first starting to talk about asset management, they were using, the industry, tended to use age as a surrogate of pipe condition. If it's 80 years old, by gosh, you're going to have to replace it. Well, maybe not. If it's 40, you're not going to have to. We're not finding that. I would really like to do a paper for AWWA talking about that, that it's not so much the age, that's part of it, that's a factor, but it's the condition of the pipe resulting from its installation practices. So that's why this type of technology is so useful. That was a great observation. Why is the older part of town, there's not that many, there are some down there, but it's not like up in that hot spot, right in that general neck of the woods there. Yeah, pretty interesting stuff. I also want to throw out that Amy, and she said she is a senior GIS specialist. She is in our utility applications group. UAS?
Yeah, that's it.
UAS.
I hate that name. We're going to find a better name one of these days. They do a remarkable job. It's not just GIS. They are leveraging technology. They are leveraging communications technology and visible technology, and this kind of tool, not this one specifically, but it's being transmitted out to the folks in the field, and it is making their life easier, both on the water side and the power side. They are constantly deploying new and upgraded technologies, and all to make life easier for our guys that are out there in the field doing the actual operations, the repairs, the maintenance. They are doing a remarkable job, and I would literally say that they are on the cutting edge, not bleeding, but cutting edge. They deploy a lot of really, really fine technology. So congratulations to Amy Cree and his entire group.
Thanks, Jim. Any other questions? Yes?
So how many complaints do you need before you start to look at an area and say, you know, we've got an underlying problem here. This is not just a once-off leak. Who looks at that? Do you look at that, or is somebody else looking
at
that?
We could, or whoever.
it's a group. It really is a group consensus.
Yeah.
Tanner, Randall, Roger, Andy, the fellows from down in operations, sit down and we talk about it. We say, you know, what do you think? It is a group consensus about where to apply limited amounts of funds in terms of replacement or rehabilitation, and whether it should be replacement or rehabilitation.
Yeah.
But it's a group consensus, and we look forward, and then that's plugged in to our 10-year capital improvement plan to replace or repair pipe.
So in that data, she's got the type of pipe that's there, when it was installed,
it,
you've got all that information.
It can include
it,
whatever information you'd like
it
to.
And I ask, I've got a friend that actually lives up the Buckhorn, and there's been high water table issues. And it was blamed on the Loudon Ditch for a while, and I know the engineer on the Loudon Ditch, and then I hear that, oh my gosh, there was some leaks. It was actually waterline leaks. So she's still got problems, and I think who at what point do you look at the data and say, okay, this could very well be this waterline? I mean, I don't know how far that information gets taken out. If you get a call and somebody says, I've got a, you know, I've done water in my basement, do you look at that and say, oh my gosh, yes, we've got a lot of history of leaks in that area, we need to take this seriously, or what, does that actually get used for that?
We would take every call very seriously.
Yeah.
This would be one more data point that we would use, but our operations staff has a really, really thorough knowledge of what's going on out there in terms of water levels, in terms of whether we've had problems there in the past. So this type of information is one more data point.
Yeah. Okay.
And by publishing this, whoever's in the internal to the organization has access to this. All I got to do is give them a link, click on the link,
they can
see
it
in the dashboard. And it's real time.
Nice.
Mm-hmm.
But we do not have water lines in the buckle.
Yes, sir.
A couple questions, and then you said you were doing other maps. I got a map idea. Do we really have a line underneath Lake Lovell?
I don't think so.
Okay, so that's just a...
Oh, that could be an outlier.
Yeah.
Sometimes, if they don't geocode it correctly, you know, we will get odd
it's
data points in there.
Yeah.
So, like, if we clicked it, intersection of fire. So it has an address on it, just went in the wrong spot.
Yeah.
There
was maybe about 20 years ago, I remember conversations from the conservation community saying, you know, leak detections and so on were, you know, not only a good way of doing business, but a good way of conservation. And some of the cynical water community would say it's cheaper to buy water than it is to go out and fix these things. It was just so costly. Given you're doing the cost analysis, what are you seeing for, I just can't see the dashboard. I mean, is it getting to the point where these things are maybe more cost effective to do compared to water market prices, or cheaper, more efficient now that you have the dashboard and you can kind of prioritize those things?
And this is fairly new, so
okay.
We haven't had this in production for very long. I mean, it's brandy new. But
given your data,
we analyze the data yearly. You create a map of what makes the most breaks on it every year.
That's showing up there, but, you know, but all leaks are different, you know, it sometimes takes longer, more material, but we're seeing on average about $4,000 cost per that we have. So in this year end, we'll look at that, and Tanner's team will look at that, and we'll say, well, we've been out there 10 times, this costs $4,000,
yeah.
And take that into consideration for replacement someplace.
We also have leak detection software that
we're
our water
using it,
folks, yeah.
We're using it quite a bit now to try to zero in on leaks. Andy's crew has got that. We've got enough staff now that we can do that.
And those work orders are also being tracked as city works, so we can display where we've been and where we've tested in this as well.
Right.
Sean, I think that attitude was more pervasive. You mentioned 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was a more pervasive attitude. I remember doing some work with a utility that shall not be named, in a state that shall not be named, and we went out to a tank, and the tank was leaking. And it was heavily corroded about 3/4 of the way up, and it was leaking. And I said, well, you know, when are you going to fix it? We're not going to fix it. Cheaper to let it leak. I had a hard time with that answer at that time, and in hindsight, it's even harder. There is something, in my mind at least, this is me personally speaking, there is something immoral about a mindset like that. If you're going to be a water professional, then you're going to have to be a good steward of that resource. And saying it's cheaper for me to let the leak go than it is to fix it, I had a real hard time with that. But I think that that was an attitude that was out there years ago. I really do. And I think it's changed.
I agree, although that sounds like Texas, though.
It was not. It was not the great state of Texas.
So the map idea is something I have familiarity with maybe 20 years ago. Quite that long. There was thought about doing active conservation replacement of indoor fixtures. And so they mapped using the parcel date, and then they overlaid indoor water use, and they found a direct link between the age of the property
and how much water they were using,
especially winter property for the indoor use.
It
affectionately got called the toilet map, and it ended up being the prioritization for replacing toilets, and they did see quite a reduction in indoor water use by using that. And again, it gets into conservation and all other stuff, but it might be a fascinating exercise.
That would be an interesting map.
Mm-hmm.
I might not call it that, but...
I can solve two mysteries for you. I'd love to see that corridor of Wilson and all those indicators, because Wilson was in 20 years ago, was the most problematic line in the town, all the way up to the tank. And the reason for that is because of the extremely tight clay soils, and the electric currents cannot flow through that clay soil, and it goes to the pipe. And the pipe was installed okay, and it was good pipe. It's just that it didn't have any sacrificial elements to it. And so the pipe corroded, and it was so, those soils were so hot that we were even degrading copper services, which I thought I'd never see, into individual homes. And so we had to go back and replace copper services for homes. That's how bad it was. To prove that point, that tank, I don't think very many people know that in 1994-95, half the dome, half the structural in that metal tank up there on the end of 29th Street was corroded because of all those electric forces. And we actually had to go under the tank and put a metal grid under that tank to direct those forces elsewhere, because half the floor in that tank was scavenged. And we had to go in and do it, and that's why you see that thick black membrane in the bottom of that tank. Mm-hmm. So that's the corridor in town, why that's there. They were wind-blown clays, they're expansive clays, and they're just deposited in that area, and that's what's causing that problem. We did leak detection from 95 to 99, and we had used a leak listening company. Was very effective at finding leaks, and we reduced, gosh, I can't remember what the number was, but it was substantial into the total meter count versus what we sold. And we could actually use that technology. If you sat in his van, use an oscilloscope, and he could hear the leaking toilets in the homes and stuff where the water was running. It was unbelievable. And you can, the reason you want to fix those leaks is we had a big one under in front of Safeway, and if you let those leaks continue, they will collapse the structure, the street structure, and everywhere we found a big leak, the streets were caving in. Mm-hmm. And we found that it would wash out the substrate underneath it. So you can fix that, and there are technologies you can go out and keep track of them. It's fantastic. This is wonderful. Mm-hmm. I wish I had this 20 years ago. but unbelievable. But there are technologies that you can go out and find those leaks and be proactive rather than have them bubble up.
Right.
You can actually go out and find them, and you can reduce it. Not too bad. We sealed up quite a few of them. And a very effective program. So what was done then, nobody remembers it, but it worked.
Our leak detection software uses listening devices. So
yeah.
They'll go stick them out
yep.
in the field and then just run them like at 2 o'clock in the morning when hardly anybody's running water.
But that's why you're having a problem. Wilson, when I saw you replacing the line in Wilson north of Eisenhower, I'm going, oh yeah.
Finally!
It was going to happen sooner or later. And the ones down south too at 600 where you show all those leaks, that whole line's got to go.
Right.
Yeah.
Jeff was a former city employee, as you can tell.
I can tell.
Yeah. and the wood line, I don't know if you know, are all the wood lines out? You mentioned
yes.
In the old part of town, all the wood
yes,
lines really, really were part of that cast iron.
Right.
So. Okay, Amy.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're awesome.
Thanks.
Good stuff.
Yeah, good. Larry likes to hear this too. He likes to know that we're being so about this leak. Items 5 and 6 are consent agenda items, and staff has reviewed and approved these items. Is there a motion to approve them, or do you want to pull them and discuss them? Don, did you understand them?
I read them.
I move to approve consent agenda items number 5 and 6.
Is there a second? Is there any more discussion? Gene, do you have a question?
Yeah, let's see. Are we talking about the directional boring contract mm-hmm. right now?
Right. Mm-hmm.
That's one of them. And okay.
Any other discussion? All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All right. Let's move on to regular agenda item number 7. Acceptance of 4.5 shares of Loud's Ditch into the water bank. And Nathan.
All right, thank you again for having me, commissioners and chair. It's fairly straightforward. We have a landowner who would like to bring in 4.5 shares of Loudon into the water bank. The area is, you can see Boyd Lake here, the kind of the northern arm of it, and Donuth Reservoir, also sometimes known as Dykeman Reservoir, right here. So it's kind of in between, very well irrigated area. It consists of about 95 acres total, about 85 of those, if I'm remembering my numbers, have been irrigated, well irrigated and well vegetated farmland. for a number of years. We've got reports back from the ditch as well as previous landowners. And so, like I said, it's fairly straightforward. They're wanting to bring in these shares. So it just kind of comes down to the LUC and whether it's acceptable to them. We have the documents ready to go as soon as the LUC has accepted these shares. So, yes?
Nathan, I recall that there's a, I'm going to call it a variety of Loudoun up in this northeastern part of town.
Yep.
That has not been historically accepted by Loveland because it doesn't, its return flows don't go to the Thompson, they go to the Pooter.
Yeah.
And, Is this not that, I assume?
Well, and I'm glad you brought that up. So the hydraulic divide comes right in this area. There's just this little tiny sliver right to the north that has been geomapped. And when we talked to the the ditch rider as well as other members of the ditch, they felt by the lay of the land, if you go out there, you'll notice that the farmland's on a pretty good hill slope. Most of it's going to drain right to Boyd Lake, and that's what they felt. Larry?
Just to add to that, I brought this up at a Loudoun ditch meeting with the board members a couple of weeks ago and specifically asked them, and they said, yes, it definitely runs back down into the Boyd Lake area direction. That was our first thought, too. We basically said anything below Donuts Lake is probably going to the Pooter. This is a piece that looks like it does work in our basin.
Yeah, and the other piece that sometimes is kind of is somewhat related to that is there's what's called Loudoun extension shares, and this particular piece of property has both regular Loudoun shares and Loudoun extension shares. So we did a little research on that, made sure that they could actually be separated, and there's no problem with that. The ditch board also confirmed that there's a market for the extension shares. We're not accepting them, but that there are people that are able to use those beyond this property. So the extension shares could still potentially be used on this property. And right now, the landowner is not interested in necessarily drying it up immediately, but they will be signing a dry-up covenant so that when that time comes and they want to utilize the shares, they can. Any other
guests? So when we were doing the, I guess it was the, maybe a water lease or something, we had a conversation about how do we as the LUC evaluate that, and it seems like we came up with some language that said, in the city's best interest,
sure,
or something to that effect. And I noticed that same language was in the municipal code with regards to the water bank.
Oh yeah,
and,
absolutely.
And I noticed in the memo that it says, staff concludes that it's in the best interest because of these reasons. Does the municipal code specify what is the best interest, or is it specifically vague to allow for staff to conclude it's in the best interest?
Larry, go ahead.
I can address that as well as I can. I don't know a specific comment that defines that, but we've always interpreted that to be as water that comes with good historic use if possible. You know, all the things that you need to be successful in doing the water court, so that we have a good expectation of coming out with true yield in the end. And so we've always interpreted it that way. Our best interest is real water at the end of the transaction.
Right, which I think is fair.
Previously you mentioned a dry-up document or some kind of an arrangement. Could you explain that again?
So whenever water is brought through the process, we want to make sure that somebody doesn't come back and put the same water that we've accepted back onto that property, because that would be basically the state considers that double dipping. And so we want to make sure that it's taken off and completely removed. The unique thing about most dry-up covenants is they allow for water to be placed on the land or to be used on the land, just not specifically those shares, or in the case of this, maybe Loudoun in general gets to be a kind of a gray area. But for example, the landowner could rent CBT, or they could use their extension shares on that property. So a dry-up covenant essentially says we're not going to use a particular type of water on that property.
So the shares are currently being used on those areas that are just
a little bit west of Boyd Lake and the blue area? Is that where they're principally used?
Yeah, essentially this entire blue area is where those 4.5 shares are used, yep.
I know that area just to the west of Boyd Lake is pretty heavily used in terms of crops.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. And they built the only area within this blue area that is not currently being irrigated is right next to Donuts Lake. Is that right, Larry?
There's an area there. The water comes around from the south side of Donut Reservoir,
yeah.
And the elevation is just a little bit too high.
Yeah.
So the ditch is out away from the road there a little ways.
Yeah, you can see it if you look at your packet, you'll see it kind of a faint, you can see it on here, but it's a real faint line, and that's where they rarely irrigated it just because of the difficulty.
Yeah, that's where I've noticed that blue area typically is not utilized for crops as much as the area that's red just to the west of Point Lake there.
Yeah, and they've been very consistent. I looked back through the historical images and saw crops consistently. Sean?
Do you have a sense for why the deposit into the water bank?
You know, there's, you never know, there's lots of different reasons, you know, just as people realize that the shares are more and more valuable and the potentially of, you know, any problems in the future as things become more stringent with bringing shares, no matter where it's at, whether it's the city level and or somewhere else. So that's my guess. I didn't personally ask for that.
Any other questions?
So what's CBG water going for now?
The last time I heard, we've heard $55,000 to $60,000 per acre foot. And
there was an article in the paper back in October about some family that on the auction on August 14th.
Yeah.
And some people needed to buy some and needed help because the share they bought was $66,000.
Yeah, I heard about the Habitat for Humanity. Maybe
I can't remember who it was. But
yeah, I heard about that as well. They ended up donating a couple of shares, but I heard about that as well. Yeah, we haven't gotten any official reports from Stratacon, which is our source, since August. So we asked, we typically are a month to 2 months behind. We asked for some more, and we anticipate bringing a cash in lieu increase and other stuff from the Raw Water Master Plan back in December is our hope. We've got things kind of ready to go. We are waiting, as you know, we are kind of waiting to figure out the best way to go forward in the way we determine cash in lieu as well as other fees. So yeah, we'll have a more complete report come December 18th.
I have an appreciation for CBT Water. Back when HP purchased Chimney Hollow, Lynn Hammond helped us buy about 60 units of CBT, and I think we got it for $1,200.
Yeah, it's amazing. And it may be 10 times that here, 100 times that.
Oh, yeah. In the future.
You know, within my lifetime, which will be kind of scary, but that's one of those things.
I move to find that the requirements of City Municipal Code Section 19.04.080 have been met, and that acceptance into the City of Loveland Water Bank of the 4.5 shares originating from stock certificate number 3784 of Loudoun Irrigating Canal and Reservoir Company is in the best interest of the City of Loveland and is hereby approved.
Second.
Okay, any more discussion? All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
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 Okay. Here, could I ask one more question?
Sure.
Larry, I can't recall when we were talking about the raw water master plan stuff, wasn't there some discussion about maybe tweaking the dedication numbers for certain ditches, and was Loudoun one of them?
They all have at least small changes that have shown up. The Loudoun credit, if I remember correctly, would be going slightly down.
Yeah.
I think two of them went up. Loudoun is currently 12.17 acre feet per share, and it would be going to 11.9.
Yeah. But this would go in under the 12.17?
No, it's the amount that it gets credited is at the time it's dedicated. So if it got dedicated tomorrow.
Not to the bank.
Not to the bank.
Got it.
To an actual
bank.
To a project.
Got it. Wanted to float in the water bank.
Yep.
The water bank's really intended to just allow people to put water in so that they can use it later. So effectively, you want to say, okay, at the point of use, this is what the water is worth.
Yeah. Okay,
yeah.
Great. Thanks for that clarification.
How many total shares are involved in the lottery system? Do you know?
400? Shares in the Loudoun system?
How many shares, total shares are in the Loudoun system?
Loudoun has 600 shares.
And I think
we own 47% of it, I think the number is.
So
and
you
I
say
think,
you own 47% of the Loudoun shares.
Yeah, and I think there's like 400 something that drain to the Big Thompson Basin.
Yeah, it's a little over 160 that drain north.
Yeah.
And then they're all associated with these Loudoun extensions here. The real original Loudoun ends here, and the Loudoun extension begins here at Donut Lake. This extension is an interesting one because the extension company owns 75% of the water in Donut Lake. And that's really unusual, these extensions that we have. There are several extensions around, but most of them are what I call dry companies. All they are is conveyance. This one actually owns water rights.
Okay. Thank you. Well, Wendy,
thank you, Ryan.
Okay. Wendy Gap Permian Project, Fifth Amendment to the Fifth Interim Agreement. Ryan, you
can
help us out.
Okay. So this is something we brought before LUC several times. I think the most confusing part of this is just the title. It's a rather wordy title. But what this is basically the city's contract agreement with Northern Water to stay as a participant in the Windy Gap Permian Project. We own units of Windy Gap. We want to be able to store more of those on the East Slope side. When the Windy Gap Permian Project is built out, they're projecting about 90,000 acre feet of storage. As a participant, we have allocated 9,587 acre feet of that to the city of Loveland. That's our participation amount in the project. This year, our fees from Northern Water for 2020, actually, for next year, is going to be $1,278,267. Our correspondence with Northern has been, we just got the invoice on that recently, the formal invoice. I think that was provided as a handout. Is that correct? Thank you, Lynn. Yeah. We'll be paying that probably in January. Is when we anticipate. Yes, sir.
I see it's addressed to you.
Well, that was just kind of a little typo mistake, but that's all right. Larry may have to fill in some of the questioning on this. He has more of the elaborate history here.
I'm just saying you had to write the check.
Yeah.
Sure, my bonus, right? Joe, no.
Real quick question, what's the progress of that project right now?
Right now, the biggest thing that's happened within the last 6 weeks is there was a purchase of the land right below the Windy Gap Reservoir on the West Slope from a family, the Schmuck is their name, the Schmuck family. And that family had opposition to the water court case that's been going on the West Slope. And the water court case is necessary because of the changes in the water rights due to some of the project here. So that's the last opposition to the water court case that should be just a procedural process to finish. Now, on this side, we're still waiting on the district court, and I don't have anything new to tell you over here. It's hopefully within the next couple of months or something, we'll hear something and get it decided. It's very likely, if it's decided as we think it will be, in favor of the project here, there will be an appeal, and we'll have to decide how to go forward from there. Meanwhile, the costs are escalating.
Jeff, I can't remember his last name.
Drager.
Yeah, I talked to him this morning. He said probably 6 months, and then they'll decide. And they're not even sure if there'll be a ruling in 6 months. But then right now they're staying away, but they may have to try to push a little bit, whatever you do to push a federal judge, which is not much, I assume.
Well, one thing you could do is go out there and start digging or blasting or something, and then have the option, push back. But I don't think we're to a point where we want to be doing anything like that yet. We have selected a contractor. I can't remember if I reported that last month. A company called Barnard is the one, and their bid included two start dates. One was May, I think, and the other's September or October. I can't remember. But anyway, about 6 months apart.
What year?
Next year.
Next year.
Next year. If that doesn't happen, I guess we'll be having to, renegotiate some numbers with them. It's my personal opinion, and it's interesting that Jeff said that to you, but I just don't see us starting in the spring of next year. I just don't think it's possible. There are too many things that need to line up. But it would be possible if things start moving by late summer or August, or fall of next year, perhaps to get started.
I saw $654 million. Is that them with the contract? With the getting
$654 million is an updated total project cost, including what's been spent so far. That's not the contractor's construction cost out there, but that's is based on using the contractor's bid numbers. And so that's higher than the number we've been talking about. It was $611 million, essentially, that we have. So this is a higher number, obviously. But it's also probably a little better number as far as being having better data and a little more firm. But time still affects this as we wait on this case.
Larry and I were discussing that. So the initial design team, I think, was Stantec, when they looked at what the bids may come in as, kind of estimating costs, and almost all of the bids that actually came in were at least 5% higher than all their costs. Was that correct?
Right.
And that includes the red wrap and a few other things.
Stantec engineering cost is what the $611 million was based on, and that was actually 90% design. It wasn't 100% design. So, there's that factor. There was a little bit of unknown information there. So we're fairly comfortable with this number, and I'm hoping that it doesn't change much on us.
And the new cost also includes stockpiling some riprap for future maintenance on the reservoir, and looking at some long-term maintenance issues to bring on site, and to have more readily available for mobilization and repair. Hey, are there any other questions about the Fifth Amendment to the Fifth Interim Agreement, Windy Gap Firming Project?
Just one comment. When we purchased the Chimney Hollow site back when with HP, the price for the whole 3,500 acres was about $1.2 million.
That was a still of a deal in land.
I do. So you mentioned the cost, and just to kind of wrap my head around what exactly we're approving, I just wanted to maybe check my logic or math. So this is, let me scroll down. I'm looking at the right one. That's 20. So this is a $12 million request for funds total, of which Loveland is $1.3 million. Is that right?
Right. That'd be about right. We're 10.5% of the total amount.
Okay. And so it was interesting. They put each of the phases cost an acre foot at the bottom. Mm-hmm. I have never noticed that before in all my years of looking at these things.
Oh, as far as the participants' amount.
So, for example, this 2021, it says, well, that's interesting. 2018 phase five cost per acre foot of storage, maybe they mean 2020, is $139.24. It's the version I'm looking at. It's right at the bottom.
$139.
So this is page 78 of the packet? Yeah, Exhibit E.
Oh.
You see that, Larry?
I'm getting there, sorry. Okay, Exhibit E. Yeah.
At the bottom where they have the total 90,000 and then 12 million, just below that, they actually give a cost per acre foot of storage.
For this phase. For
correct, right.
Just this phase.
So I added up all the phases, uh-huh. And it comes to $824 an acre foot, which obviously isn't the project.
Right.
It's
right.
Just, is, and right. So that's where my question is that permitting?
That's been permitting and engineering design.
And mitigation, the schmuck stuff?
The stuff that has been paid for mitigation, yes.
Yeah.
It's,
which is interesting, because I don't know that when we Loveland went into this, that you have sort of a sense for what are we going to pay to get to where you even begin construction.
Right.
And that's an interesting data point. I don't, you know, be curious what NISP is or the other permitting projects.
So what, well, based on
$1,000 an acre foot just to sort of get to a permit.
What's the 654 million divided by the acre foot come to total acre foot?
I can punch it out for you here.
Yeah, when we were closer to the $611 million cost for the project before this last update, we estimated that it was costing about $7,000 per acre foot of storage in the project. Is that correct? I know that includes all the costs at that time were being projected.
Is Northern what?
$7,270 per acre foot per acre program cost.
Did they amortize that into their revenues costs for
the amortization?
Storage over to charge us?
Do you remember, I think Jim Lees has talked about that too, the amortization of the project costs over the construction phase?
I don't have a number here for that. If you're asking what the annual payment would be.
I guess it would match the bonds, huh? Would the bonds a 30-year bond?
Yeah, the probably 30-year bond. That seems to be where most people are settling in. Of course, we do have cash for part of it.
What's the interest charge?
True.
Great. Okay, any other questions? All right.
I move to recommend the City Council approve the Fifth Amendment to the Fifth Interim Agreement with the Municipal Subdistrict of Northern Colorado Water Conservancy District Windy Gap Firming Project Water Activity Enterprise for continued participation in the Windy Gap Firming Project and authorize the City Manager to execute the agreement.
Second.
There's a second. Any more discussion? All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Right.
I have, after the vote, it may not be a big deal, but each of those exhibits, as I look closely at it, when they break out that cost per acre foot, all but the first one says 2018. The first one says 2015. Or
the interim agreement for the fifth phase, the fifth interim agreement, I think it started in 2016. And then now we're at the fifth amendment to that. So the first table, I think, in there starts in 2016. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, 159.
So Exhibit D is an example. It says estimated phase five cost in 2019, $10 million. And at the bottom it says 2018 phase five cost per acre foot of storage. I think it's just a type, like they, somebody copy pasted that 2018 and it just carries through all those exhibits.
I think you're right.
Oh, okay, I see what you're saying.
It's neither here nor there,
footnotes.
But it, you know,
okay.
It'd be a nice jab at Norton. Here's our $1 million and fix the typo.
Right. No, I was referring to Exhibit A starts in 2016 and then goes through with the amendments to the Fifth Amendment being 2020.
Good. Thanks, Ryan.
Thank you for your time.
Commissioner Council reports. Steve, why don't we start with you?
Oh, that'd be easy. So we didn't have a council meeting on October 22nd, didn't have a council meeting on October 29th. Our meeting on November 5th was election, so business was light, and we adjourned to watch the results. November 12th, it was a swearing in. We didn't do much business with that either. And, so the first real meeting we had was last night. And that went to 11 o'clock p.m. Most of the probably the busiest stuff was on vaping. We had a cast of thousands to come speak to us. They were a little exaggeration.
I don't think I've ever seen that many people.
They want you guys to start vaping?
They're promoting it. they're trying to get council to make some, they'd like to ban vaping, raise the age on being able to buy the vaping tools from 18 to 21. They want to eliminate flavors. They want to start requiring licensure for people, for businesses selling cigarettes and vaping stuff, consider taxing and so forth. So there's a whole bunch of things. Basically, council said, well, we're not adverse to licensing. Some are not adverse to raising the age. I am. Some are adverse to eliminating flavors. So council is very divided on the whole issue. So there's a small segment of what council can agree on. So that will more to come.
And as a home rule city, a municipality can do that? They can change age limits?
The legislature changed some laws. The way the law did stand, if you fooled around with tobacco, you lost the money that you could get through from tobacco. That law has changed, so now cities are authorized to make whatever changes they want. Most of the communities that have made some changes to vaping laws are the mountain communities. And Colorado is one of the highest youth vaping problems among areas in the country. And Larimer is the highest of the counties. So it's a significant concern. Roughly 30% of the students are vaping. That's a lot. And it's happened very quickly. Caught everybody out there. So we're going to have to do something. It's what we can get council to agree on. So that's a big thing.
Yeah, anecdotally, a neighbor of mine is a teacher, I think, middle school. And his comment was they vape like their life depends on it.
Yeah.
Just anecdotal comment.
Yeah.
Their life does depend on it.
Well, the big problem is, and we had youth advisory, four ladies from the youth advisory, which there's 16 students on the youth advisory commission. And they're pretty passionate about it. They feel that the youth have been targeted. Could be some truth to that. They feel that flavors are the biggest problem because that's the attractive thing. And basically those that vape say, well, there's no adverse health consequences. There's nothing wrong with it. There's no risk.
Wow.
And so they're very uninformed. And if they're using a Juul has very high nicotine, and they get hooked pretty quickly, and it's hard to break that habit. So it was a lively discussion, a long discussion, but it was important. So I had nothing to do with you guys.
Any other questions for Steve? Okay. John, you got anything?
Nothing this month.
Yeah. Did you? We kind of jumped over, since being a new member, the consent agenda, the substructure and the boring contracts. Do you understand? Those are kind of annual things that we do, and they're on the consent agenda because we approve them and we need them. And if we don't need them, we don't pay them.
Mm-hmm. So, I thank you for asking.
Yeah.
Nothing.
Okay.
Dan?
I have nothing.
John?
John's down the water. No, I'm just looking up something a little bit ago on Colorado Water for Sale, and I noticed there's 70 acre feet or 70 shares of CBT water for sale, $60,000 a share, and it's under contract.
Wow.
And we're sitting at about 30 right now for cash in lieu?
No, it's more than that.
It's 40,000.
For 40,000 for cash in lieu? And you had mentioned something about we're going to try to bring that back next month.
Yeah, we will. I'll have a comment on that in just a second.
Okay.
Yep.
Don't have anything.
Sean?
No.
Gene? I wrote a real good recommendation for Dave Clark. I didn't want
to. Yeah. Yeah. That was a shame.
Yes.
Larry?
Yeah, I actually do. I was at the Northern Water thing this morning, and I was going to bring up that. First of all, the CU professor echoes kind of what the CU, the CSU guy does, the same thing with heating up with the temperatures, and we've gone up 2 degrees in the last 40 years, is going to make it more arid, and even though the precipitation level may not change. And then there was a woman from Fort Collins Water Board, or a staff person, and they just did their long-term 30-year plan, and actually they used what I wished we used, but we didn't, that going from traditional historical planning to risk-based future, which in, they did 20 models, I think, and part of it based on the plus side of plus. More precipitation that balances out the arid effects of climate change and increasing, and also more on the other side where the probability tends to be reduced flows that will be available in the Front Range to come up with either the one they want to pick or the mix of that. So I still say that our historical trend, which I remember, and I brought up and was told that's what we're doing, as opposed to, I thought we ought to have some alternatives that include the effects of climate change, especially when we're doing 30 years. So that's what they've kind of switched to, which I wish we would have done. And I got even thinking more, I'm not even sure that, if I remember rightly, the rule for what the 30 years is based on that we use is that we would not have to restrict watering in a 100-year drought. And I almost really think maybe it's time that the council ought to tell staff or somebody to revisit if even that's appropriate anymore. It may not be appropriate. But anyway, I was very impressed with it, Fort Collins, and I thought that was a good, you know, the lawyers, pardon me, is that we have one lawyer in the room. The lawyers were a little boring, but when you have five of them, whatever we had, but I enjoyed it.
More attorneys are always better.
Oh, there's two. Yes.
Because they're all billing. Grand
deal. I'll add one thing quick. So when we were in Italy for cooking school, one afternoon we were in a small town about 90 miles north of Rome. Small town of probably 8,000 people, and we were at the old market area of store, and I'm looking in the cheese shop, and I hear a woman yell, "Larry." And I turned around, and it was Gretchen Sandler. We're celebrating with her, and I'd never met her husband before. And so for their 40th birthday, they were doing 3 weeks in Italy.
She's not very good at small work.
She's not very good at stocking.
Well, I wanted to make a comment about the wastewater treatment plant grand opening.
Yeah.
I was it was an impressive project. Not only was it one of the biggest projects we've ever done, but we did it while treating all of our waste. So that's pretty impressive. And talking with Tom Green and other employees, I was really impressed about how proud they were of the project. It was a big, good project that turned out really well.
Yeah. It did. Thank you. And with some staff changes down there over the last several months, last year or so, I think that plant has really turned around, and you've got now the new technology and the larger capacity. It is a fine, fine plant. So thank you for saying that. It was a fun day. A little chilly, but a fun day.
Yeah. Okay, I think we're ready for director's report.
Just a couple of quick things, Mr. Chair. Next month, in addition to, we're going to be bringing back in two phases. Next month, we've been working very hard on the cash and lieu calculations. We have to come up with something that is supportable, defensible, and makes sense in terms of the market going up as we know it. We also need to be very cognizant of the fact that water is a driver of development, and we want to support development. So it's not like we can simply say we want to make it $100,000, whatever. We can't do that. So we have to make it, we've been working very, very hard with our rate consultant, Jim Lees, and his staff, with Larry, Roger. We've been going through a lot of iterations, and I think we're ready to bring back cash in lieu next month, and then some of the other things like the native water storage fee and so on in January. But we do want to get, we do have, I think, a pretty good recommendation for the cash in lieu price that makes sense philosophically and it makes sense financially. So that'll be next month. Next month, we're also bringing back the master, well, not be bringing back, bringing the master plan for Loveland Water and Power. Several months ago, in conjunction with the master plan activities that are going on citywide, I thought it was appropriate. In my opinion, this department has always planned. They've always planned. They know what's coming up. They've planned for development. They've planned for rehabilitation. They have planned. They've just never had it put down in a written document. And that's what this is. And it conforms and ties to the language and the direction of the city's master plan. It is mercifully short. Water and Power is mercifully short. There's a lot of photographs. And it's a lot of bullet points. I hope you will find it enjoyable. We will be bringing back for your approval and adoption. We have taken it through the division managers, Water and Power staff, the other department directors here in the city, and I have sent courtesy copies both to Northern Water and to our PRPA, our regional partners. So we'll be bringing that. That will be in the packet for next month. As Tim mentioned, and you saw the photograph, the Water Quality Lab project is progressing very, very well. It is now buttoned up, which I'm sure that the tradesmen down there and the workers are very happy about that. So it's going to be inside work this winter, and they'll get through that. And we are looking for a late May, early June opening. Of course, there will be a ceremony for that. It is a beautiful, beautiful facility, and it's going to be just great. And finally, there has been, obviously everybody's heard about the issues in Flint, Michigan with lead. The lead and copper rule was originally promulgated in 1991 as a result of the 1986 amendments to the Safe Drinking Water Act. Nobody in the water profession that I've ever met supports lead and copper in water. However, most of the people that I've met in the water profession hate the lead and copper rule as it exists. It is very confusing. It is not like it's an MCL where your limit for lead is 10 micrograms per liter. And that's an MCL. If you go above it, you violate it. It's not like that. It's a very different regulation. It is very hard to explain to consumers. It's very hard to present in the annual consumer confidence report because it talks about confidence levels, 90%, so on. Well, in light of it was coming prior to Flint, but Flint kind of accelerated the process. And so over the last year, they have been eking out the proposed revised lead and copper rule. And it was finally published on in Federal Register on November the 11th. We will be making some comments back to EPA. They did not help things at all. It is more confusing than ever. I don't think it advances public health. I think there are portions of it that are absolutely unworkable. We are in very, very good shape. The program that Tim talked about in conjunction with TSD was an absolutely marvelous program. We don't have lead in our water. It typically comes from the fixtures, the lead service line, or fixtures inside the home. School district, there were a couple where there were some higher levels, some elevated levels. They pulled those fixtures out. It's been a great, I think as a city, we are in much better shape, but as an industry, this rule does not do any favors for the industry, unfortunately. We've got to do something about lead. I'm not sure this is the right way to go about it. So that's all, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Everybody be careful on the way home. I think it's raining out.
Does the lead and copper actually dissolve in the water?
You can have both. You can have both dissolved species and suspended species. Suspends.
Just to go back to the strategic plan, December 10th, we will be discussing the strategic plan in council. My experience by looking at the what are called strategic plans for most of the departments is that are tactical plans are not strategic plans. And so Leah Bowder's been working with the departments to try to get that shifted. And so we will be looking for to come with an overall strategic plan with the city, which is, we never had. Which then each department's going to have to filter into that, which will allow us to set broad policy decisions that then can be implemented by departments. So this is something that council feels very strongly about. It's very timely.
What do you mean by tactical? Like operational?
Fix this problem, fix that problem. You know, we got to do X number of miles of roads, you know, we got to plow the roads. Those kinds of things. It's very good at solving problems, addressing problems. It's not good at really developing a strategy for where that department's going.
I hope you see that there are no numbers in this strategic plan.
How did an engineer get through a report with a bit of time? Because I wanted to be an English teacher.
No, it really is. It's very, very high level. As I said, I think we've always planned. This just kind of forms up in different areas, and like I said, they conform to the strategic focus areas that are in the city's plan, and that's explained in there in the preparatory material that's here. And then under each of these strategic focus areas, there are bulleted, very broad brush. This is what we will do to support this strategic initiative. And it's not build a new tank. It's not, you know, change or underground 15% more power lines. It's not that. It's philosophy, not tactics.
Anybody have anything else? Okay, we're adjourned.
Thank you, Lynn. Thank you,
Thank
Corinne.
You.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Thanks, Steve.
I missed a couple meetings, but did I show up?
I participate.
And then I didn't know Tim Bowling.
I was an alternate for about a year, too. So, yeah, I know. Yeah.
I know, they're
good.
So cute.
Getting them here in the wings ready to go when somebody steps down.
Cool.
Well,
thank you.
You've lived in love a long time?
I have. Since, let's see, 1970.
Yeah, thank you for catching.
Yeah, moved from Fort Collins.
Thanks, Gary.
My wife was a high school principal. She didn't really want to live in the same town.
I know.
People were calling all the time. And so.
You can't go to the grocery store. You can't do anything.
That's right. There was no doubt.
I didn't see Frank either.
I'll leave this with you, and you can discredit it.
Yeah,
I don't think I need to take that home with me.
Okay,
thank you so much.
You.
All right, you too. Good night.